Hello.
And welcome back to This Is Not
a History
Lecture. This week, your guests are Mal. Your guest is just Mal. So mm-hmm. We do not have Kitty, Appa, or Fry in the
regular
with
stars.
Us today.
No, just Mouse. But she will make herself known.
Yes,
we are sure of it. Yes.
You'll hear some chomps or a tail hitting something or talons hitting the floor. But with these sensitive mics, hopefully it won't pick up too much.
Yeah, yeah. Let's roll the intro.
Yeah.
This is not a history lecture with Kat and Kaylee.
All right, Kat, how are we doing today?
Pretty good. As you can tell, things are haywire for us a little bit everywhere all the time.
You know, I would say it's one of those days, but it seems like every day is one of those days. These
at
days.
This point, yeah.
I'm saying days too many times.
You're 100% correct. But this is episode 154, which means it's not a theme, but next week is.
Yay!
We also would like to make the disclaimer that I didn't realize it till last week. Cal realized it on Christmas Eve.
Oh, yeah, and then promptly forgot.
Yeah, that we didn't post a Christmas episode as planned. We're conscious enough to be like, hey, we're going to be short. Let's record one before we both get back from
vacation. Just miscalculated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I messed up the numbers.
That's all right. That's all right.
Shocking, if you know me, that I can't do math.
Considering it was the day after Christmas, we hope that y'all will forgive us.
Oh, was it the day after or Christmas?
It was like, Christmas was Monday and then like 10 a.m. on Tuesday.
And to be fair, we were both dealing with a lot of stuff.
Yeah. I realized on Christmas Eve and I was like, crap, because we're both going to be busy.
Yeah.
Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, and then it goes out Tuesday morning. Like, we can't.
Yeah, we were.
Yeah.
And I didn't even have my recording equipment with me in Lubbock. I had it in Dallas.
Yeah, so.
So, we apologize for that.
Yep, yep. It's okay.
We're back on schedule.
Yeah, we took a little vacation. Unintentionally.
Threw me off when I was calculating. Yeah.
counting them up. Yeah.
Because I was like, this should be. Oh, no.
Hold on.
This should be episode 155, but this is 154.
Yep.
And who are you going to be talking about today?
Today, I am talking about an event.
Ooh,
known
fun?
As the Great Train Robbery of 1963.
I don't know what this is.
It's a fun one.
But I am so excited for it.
It's a fun one. You should be excited.
I need the Great Train Robbery. Mouse?
If you hear a distant rumbling, she's chewing on a bone.
And hoping that under the table, mics, you don't hear that. But
yeah,
if you do,
yeah.
She'll last usually about a minute before she gives up.
And yeah, so she's our backing track for now.
Yeah.
And then we'll, we'll have. This is the drama of the intro. And then,
yeah, that's the rumbling of the train engine, actually.
There we go. There we go.
This is ambiance for y'all, actually.
Yeah. On theme.
Uh huh.
We worked with our sound engineer.
Yeah, this was. Mouse is now taking that honorary title. Well, mine is a person. I realized after I did this person that mm-hmm. I've done a lot of people recently and less so events. So next week I'm switching back to some cool events and stuff mm-hmm. like that. But this mm-hmm. week I'll be talking about Don Mellett.
Okay. I don't know who that is.
A reporter who was assassinated.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Scandal.
Very interesting. I know. So I guess if you want to learn about these things, you can stick around and find out why this is not a history lecture.
Yeah.
Cue the intro you just heard.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I say let's go for it.
Yeah.
Let's jump. Let's get into it.
So is there anything I just realized, anything we need to like update the world on? I think
Ron DeSantis just dropped out of the presidential race.
We literally just like.
Yeah. Like not even an hour ago. Yeah.
Found that out, so
yep
that's fun.
Interesting developments there.
Yeah, we've just had a really interesting time because right before this I enlisted Cal to help me move a piece of furniture into my apartment
mm-hmm.
and so we're still coming off of that high. But yeah, so I'll talk to y'all about Don Mellett and the assassination that changed a lot of people's opinion and the way that we look at investigative journalism.
Okay.
So.
Yeah. I'm so ready. This is interesting.
I was kind of disappointed at how little I found out about this guy. About how little I found source-wise on him. I expected to find, like, pages and pages because this was in the mm-hmm. 1920s. So
oh,
it's
yeah.
within 100... Well, I think 26 was the assassination year. So about 90...
It's like modern history. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you know, and for something that was as documented and talked about as this, I really expected more. But The small amount I did find, a lot of it was behind paywalls or reviews for books on him, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a very interesting search, and it came up with a little less. You'll find if you like Google him and look for sources, it's probably varied information of this same thing that I'm going to talk about today.
Mm-hmm.
So just want to make that known. I also kind of wondered if when you're writing about corruption and standing up against it, if some of your information kind of goes away after you die. And there's not as much people to write about in 100 years or so. So that's just something I kind of wondered how much of an impact that historiography had on it.
Yeah.
But anyway.
It's a good thing to consider.
Yeah. Yeah. It especially if you're thinking about like the Prohibition era.
Right. Yeah.
Like all that's going on in this time. Prohibition was benefiting and hurting many different people, so a lot of people had very different vested interests in hushing this up or getting rid of it or investigating it in some ways. But Don Mellott, whose full name was Donald Ring Mellott, was born on September 26th of 1891 in Elwood, Indiana. He was the youngest of seven boys. Like,
wow.
Long family.
Yeah.
Long line of boys, I should say.
Yeah.
His father was involved in publishing, specifically establishing and founding the Elwood Gazette, which was kind of a big influence on him in his younger years because he grew up around it, around the idea of investigation, and his brothers did too. The official position of his father eventually was the editor. So he had early exposure to everything from the writing style down to the actual process of printing. And he started to... Sorry, I'm...
Mouse, come here, baby. You're just being so loud.
She's got two of her toys she right here. Two.
One of them is silent. Hold on.
Okay. She's... Oh my gosh. Do not do it, Mouse. Do not come and
just let her do what she's going to do. It's just going to prolong She'll go things.
Sit on the rug on the other side of the room. Yeah. Okay, that's better.
the sound, wonders of parenthood.
Yeah. And the Oscar for sound and audio editing goes to Mouse.
Well, she just have those big old ears, so
that's true.
If anyone's going to be our sound editor, it's her.
It's Mouse.
Yep.
So he kind of gets his first own foray into the active process of writing in high school. He becomes the school's newspaper editor, and it was actually in high school that he meets Florence, who would eventually become his wife. Very cute young love.
Nice. Cute.
I had to remind myself that this is the 1920s, so that's probably far more common than our time.
Yeah.
You know, meet someone young and kind of build a life with them. And also, let me look at the date. Yeah, okay, this is probably right before, this is before the war. Okay. So he graduated from Shortridge High School in 1909, and he and one of his childhood friends decides to go to Indiana University in Bloomington. Good school. He gets very involved in a myriad of different things while he's there. Pursuing college, he stays there for 3 years until 1913, when he gets sick during I think he pushed himself too hard. A very long and drawn-out cross-country event that he, like, overexerted himself so hard that he became ill because of it. I don't know if it was a long-term illness. Or maybe he, like, had an injury to, like, his... Like, a permanent injury to his muscles or something. Or if he, like, drove himself to, like, clinical exhaustion and just never recovered or what. But he ended up leaving school because of it. So that tells me that it's more than just, like, oh, I sprained my ankle. It's something pretty bad.
Yeah.
'Cause 3 years in, you usually don't stop schooling that close to the finish line. But he was involved in the school paper at that time in journalism. The Daily Student was the name of the paper that they had. And when he was there, he really started leaning into this expository style of journalism and the advocacy side of what journalism could do. He was trying to get the university a really good water system. And eventually, Bloomington grants it to the university partially because of his efforts just writing the school paper.
So,
it kind of tells you that he's kind of fighting for the underdog, but also for, like, advocacy things. Not just, like, did you hear about Penny on the third floor making out with Ronnie on the fourth? You know, all it's that
jazz. Not a gossip columnist.
Mouse, no. Get over here. I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's okay. I understand.
She was going to sit on Kaylee's jacket and chew her toy there, which would end up with a lot of slobber.
I didn't even realize it fell. I'll pick it up.
I'm so sorry. My dog is... We really got to train our dogs for it's studio behavior.
Oh, my God. Who raised these guys?
I know, right? I feel like I'll give her a little bit of leeway because she's a street dog that's just learning behavior, but...
Yeah. Mine's an old man, so what are you going to do?
Yeah, we give them both leeway.
Yeah.
So, along with 5 of his 6 brothers, he gets into journalism professionally. Which, that means it's like a long family legacy.
Yeah, that is like the family business.
Uh-huh. Yeah, even out of university, he didn't particularly need to finish that degree at the time to get the jobs he did. And he gets a job at the Indianapolis News first. And then the National Enquirer, which is run by a previous governor named Frank Hanley. It was considered a prohibition paper. So that tells you a lot about what they're writing about, what their focus is, and the stuff that's going on in this time as he starts mm-hmm. getting into writing. And it forms how he writes, what he's writing about, the mm-hmm. expository style, et cetera, et cetera. And he accrued quite the repertoire of involvement. After some experience there, he decides to purchase his own paper, at which he becomes the editor. It was called the Columbus Ledger. And eventually he goes on to work at the Akron Press as an advertising manager. That job in Akron is officially what brought him and his wife and 4 kids at the time to Ohio in 1923.
Mm-hmm.
So that stint at the Akron Press was a bit short-lived, but it did kind of get him into Ohio and in proximity to these 2 jobs that he would be offered. The first was in Cleveland, but it was offered simultaneously to a job in Canton, Ohio, and he turns down the one in Cleveland to go work at the Canton office, which mm-hmm. it was the Canton Daily News, in January of 1925. And this is where the story is going to kind of turn away from his favor, because this is where things start getting kind of twisted, and I'm sure that he knew what he was doing and the risks he was taking, so yeah. he probably did took this job with the knowledge of what he wanted to do, but he was a pretty big player at this paper, at the Canton Daily News. It wasn't the most influential in town. The paper had about 50% of the readership that the other large town paper was receiving at the time. It was known as the Repository, and the competitor paper was, it tended to be a Republican-leaning paper,
mm-hmm.
and so it had most of the readership in the town. But as the Canton Daily News starts advocating for the Democratic candidate that's running for mayor, it starts getting a little bit more of a readership, and it actually helps get this man, this Democrat, elected as mayor. And through all of this, his goal had been to accrue or accumulate more of a readership. And it's working, shocking for an area that's so heavily Democratic, but nonetheless, he manages it, and in the month, I mean, I've already said it, he's gonna die, spoiler. In the month before his death, I think they were like 10,000 readers below the Repository, and wow. within that month, closed like 5,000 more in that gap. So, like, wow. he was making quick progress for this paper. But most notably, this paper becomes known and put in the public eye because of the corruption that they're reporting on. And that was mm-hmm. something directly that he directly had a hand in working on and kind of seeking out that style of writing and those topics.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not just corruption in like mob and prohibition and rum running and stuff like that we might normally think of. He gets involved reporting on corruption within the police. And that's a really great way to get yourself killed.
Yeah.
That's like...
You know what? You are so right. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because like the mob, like, yeah, you know that you're putting yourself at risk. But mm-hmm. reporting on police corruption, especially mm-hmm. in this time, is not going to be great for you. It's not going to
end
well.
No, no, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is prohibition. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, no, no.
Uh-huh. So he had actually written about the mob and the crime that they... Mouse, what are you eating? Okay. that they had been pursuing actively in the community. Enough so that he got 2 mobsters arrested.
Wow.
So he was kind of on everyone's hit list, which is, again, not a great place to be during the Prohibition era. And he put enough pressure on the mayor through this paper that they suspend the chief of police for corruption. The mayor officially cited that he disliked the treatment the police had been giving to criminals, and that the police force itself was being inefficient. But this was very much like a result of Don Mellott's, you know, reporting and what he was learning and publishing. And he wasn't holding back on the information he was finding or publishing or anything like that. So mayor can say all he wants, but a lot of people are like, yeah, this dude's on my list right now of not so favorites. And this is like, it's really hard to describe the mentality of Prohibition era because like everyone knows mobsters are a thing.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people are still in this, like, oh, the police will protect us mindset. So to realize very jarringly that the police aren't always on the people's side, that a lot of them are corrupt, are being paid off by mob and mafia officials, et cetera, et cetera. It's a very difficult thing for some people to grasp.
Yeah.
So he's driving up readership through all of this. And by the spring of 1926, they're competing with pretty much the same readership. He doesn't really stop with just organized crime and payoffs, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
He decides to take it a step further and just call out anyone that's corrupt, which includes a surgical chief at a local hospital who was appointed but was clearly incompetent and dangerous to his, you know. Yeah, so he's calling
He
out
was a
police.
Journalist.
Yeah, police,
yes.
Medical, organized
crime.
Oh,
he was causing trouble in Ohio.
Uh-huh. Also calls out the Board of Education.
Oh.
Like, for corruption, like, this guy is literally, like,
everyone,
lots of enemies, lots of people who probably aren't gonna be friends with him after this. And through all this, he has started to pay a lot of attention to a man named Paul Kitzig, who was involved with the mob, but was also known to let information slide here and there, and may have been a rat against the mob. And Paul Kitzig, is murdered. And Don Mellott starts watching very closely, looking for information and whoever might actually be behind the murder itself. Through his investigating, he decides that his main suspect for the murder of Paul Kitzig is Ben Rudner, who is... I'm so sorry. I'm going to take that squeak toy away from Mouse. Okay, we are back. Mouse is now in my lap so that she'll stop eating chew toys and squeakers. But yes, he publishes evidence that he can find against Ben Rudner as a suspect in this murder. And this doesn't sit well with anyone, especially Ben Rudner, in the crime syndicates. And Don Miller has officially, at this point, I'm going to say officially because he starts receiving death threats. He's officially on people's radars. Death threats, threats against, you know, his physical safety, et cetera, et cetera. But he hires a bodyguard for a little bit, thinking that this might keep him safe. Whether or not he stopped hiring that bodyguard because of a financial strain, or maybe he thought he just was past the worst of it or something like that, he decides to stop employing this bodyguard, which I can't say, you know, for sure whether it would have saved his life to have a bodyguard when this happened, but...
But it sure might have helped.
It might have helped, yeah. Soon after this, he definitely wished he still had said bodyguard.
Mm-hmm.
Because on July 16th of 1926 in Canton, Ohio, at 34 years old, Don Mellott is shot in the head in his garage. The bullet enters his skull right above his left ear, and another bullet flies through the kitchen and through his wife's hair.
Oh,
narrowly
shit.
Her. Yeah. Which it brings questions on, were they both meant to be fatal shots?
Right, yeah.
Was it just after him and the other was a stray, et cetera, et cetera. And we never actually find out who pulled the trigger, so we don't know for sure who intended to hit who, what, where, when, how, why. But the resulting investigation is obviously a big deal, and it should have been like a blowout national coverage, like, investigative journalist gets murdered headline.
Right.
But It's also a very intimidating and terrifying one for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. They're like, that guy just ran his mouth and he got killed.
Yeah.
I'm not really keen to eager to take up the mantle.
Uh-huh. Well, at this level of corruption, it's hard to know what's truth and what's lie. And it's not questioned initially, like the police work on the case, because everyone's like, oh, the police have done what they can and collected the evidence. Mm-hmm. But then people are like, hey, wait a second.
Wasn't he
investigating police corruption?
You know who would be the best one to cover up police corruption?
The police. Because the original police investigation turns up pretty much nothing.
Mm-hmm.
No party responsible, uh-huh. No evidence, uh-huh. No nothing.
Convenient.
And it's important to note that involved in this is, like, the chief of police that Don had originally been investigating and talking about.
Oh, yeah.
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 And so people in the public start questioning enough of this that there is an outside source named Aura Slater who comes in and is, thankfully, able to look into the murder with a little bit more...
A little bit more removed.
Yeah, what's the word?
Objective.
Objective, empirical kind of mindset. Yeah. And... Slater, not kind of being involved in the previous investigations or crimes, does the work that the police couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
There's also an effort from the editor of the Akron Press, L.E. Judd, who ends up very involved with the investigation and research, and I want to note that as well, that other investigative journalists, while knowing the risks of getting involved in something like this, still did. And that's pretty dang brave, to watch a coworker mm-hmm. or colleague get murdered for this work and be like, yeah, I got this.
Yeah.
I'm coming up on it too.
Yeah.
And this eventual search and consensus of information finds that Rudner, the man that Don Millett had been looking into, had introduced these two men from the underworld to a bootlegger and decided that he wants the editor, Don Millett, killed. Not just beaten up or threatened or intimidated, but he wanted him killed.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, one of those men had backed out and disappeared, but it left two men in line to kill Millett, a man with the last name Streitenberger and another one with the last name McDermott. Charges end up falling on four people. Ben Rudner, obviously, and then those other two I just listed, and as well as the chief of police. They all get charged with this crime. And another named Mazur was also charged with manslaughter in there. But unsurprisingly, even though all four were sentenced to life in prison, they decide later that the chief of police was not either involved or deserving
right.
of that sentence.
Yeah.
And
he's a good man. He's the chief of police.
Mm-hmm. He's mm-hmm. acquitted. So, you know. Unfortunately, they never find out which person actually fired the bullet that killed Don Millett. And they never found the gun either. And that brings the question of, how long did this investigation take? Did maybe the police have the chance to help destroy evidence
mm-hmm.
on the scene immediately? Was it work afterwards, et cetera, et cetera? But they were trying to like kind of figure out exactly who fired, and their suspicions were on Ben for a long time, since he was like the one that was directly called out by Don Millett and would have the biggest vendetta and everything, but
mm-hmm.
they really can't know for sure. At the end of the day, unfortunately, Don Millett was buried in Indianapolis and became, you know, famous for speaking out against corruption and investigating it. Oh my gosh, I am so sorry, guys. Mouse is just really, really way more hyper than she usually is right now. And their paper, the Canton Daily News, receives a Pulitzer Prize for public service about a year after Millett actually dies, mostly for, you know, fighting against corruption and all that. But they also kind of make a statement to honor Millett, not just, you know, the paper, but it's all of the journalists who are working mm-hmm. with him and for what he eventually gave up, his life, in order to do that work.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, without Don, whether it's because Don Millett wasn't there or the type of town they were in, et cetera, et cetera, that paper within the year ended up being bought out by the rival paper, The Repository. that they had been competing against for so long just because they didn't have the viewership, which is really sad that you can win a Pulitzer and do that kind of work and it's gone.
Yeah, so and literally easily. Die for it. Yeah.
Yeah. But in some ways, this crime was portrayed as like, a journalist has been murdered and attempted to be silenced and everything just spun out of control and he got murdered, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But for the rest of the world, I think it probably has to do with your proximity. Like, it's easier if you're in that city mm-hmm. locally to be like, a member of our community was murdered and this is all a terrible tragedy. But for a lot of people across the U.S., seeing a police chief involved, seeing organized mm-hmm. crime with this, they're like, hey, this is actually... This is actually a push against their First Amendment rights to freedom of press. Mm. Like, and it is a crime to, what is the exact term? Not intimidation of the press. There's another word for it. Where you like, essentially, if you try to intimidate or coerce someone in the press.
I'm not sure. Yeah, I don't know. I
cannot think of the actual term for it, but it garnered a lot of attention, not just because of the corruption he was researching, but for the constitutional implications of what it meant to threaten someone, a member of the press, into mm-hmm. publishing something or not mm-hmm. publishing something, and what happens when you intimidate the rest of the press members by killing one of their colleagues, making it very clear what happens right. if you're going to get into this expository line of work. Mm-hmm. It spurred a lot of other newspapers to write about the event, demanding that something be done. And so, partially out of fear for themselves, like, hey, what if all of our expository newspapers get caught up in this kind of thing? Like, we can't not write. Like, we deserve to get to talk mm-hmm. about this stuff and address it, especially if it has to do with our own communities being taken advantage of and, mm-hmm. and corruption in our own leadership. But in 1969... he was posthumously, obviously, inducted into the Indiana Journalism Hall of Fame. There are a lot of honors named after him, prizes and scholarships, like the Don R. Millett Prize at New York University, among many, many others. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of sites and buildings named after him as well. And a surprising amount of books, not surprising amount, but I found like it was a good amount of books were written about him. Some based around his actual writing and the research he did and everything, and some others more about his life and personal approach to his work. I think both would probably be really interesting and really valid mm-hmm. because I'm assuming that a lot of this is written about because he was involved in journalism. And as a writer, he's surrounded by other people who want to write about his experiences right, yeah. and the importance of his work. But he kind of became almost like a martyred figure.
Yeah.
For, you know, not just fighting against corruption, but First Amendment rights. Yeah. And that spurs an even bigger conversation about stuff right now mm-hmm. in the world we are living in. Because there are members of the press in war zones and doing expository work right now mm-hmm. that are actively being fired at and yes. their families are being killed. And Al Jazeera especially has been talking about this recently, that like members of their staff have been murdered mm-hmm. while identified as press, which is illegal. Mm-hmm. You cannot do that.
War crime. Yeah.
And, or their families have been actively targeted and murdered mm-hmm. almost in their entirety. So that's kind of one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this today is because, in a historic contextual setting, fighting against corruption, it's very important to understand the implications of these things, but even more so just what it means now in the world and how we view the importance of free writing.
Mm-hmm.
So even though I didn't find a ton of sources and information on Don Mellott, I wanted to give him a space to be talked about today and kind of discuss the importance of that. So that is the unfortunate and yet important life of Don Mellott and the work he was doing.
Wow. Yeah, I had never heard of him.
Yeah, I only heard of him a few weeks ago and I was like, that rings kind of important right now.
Yeah, topical. Well, good job. I am glad you talked about that too, because you kind of, like, journalism has this really interesting place it plays, like, in our society.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people kind of just chalk it up to, like, oh, it's just, you know, they either talk about frivolous stuff or they just talk about literally what happened. But there is investigative journalism.
Right.
And there are people who do seriously risk themselves and their families.
Yes.
To do what they see as right.
Yeah.
And he was calling out corruption, as he should have done as a journalist in a town, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And he should have had the right to do so.
And I think we lose a lot of that, too, because so much of our... how we hear news is from social media now, mm-hmm. especially mm-hmm. our younger generations, that we forget that, like, on the other side of that social media, stories have to be broken.
Yep.
Not just by the people posting videos about it because they were there, which I'm so glad we have, because there's so much more, like, primary sources. You can see videos of stuff happening in real time and people's experiences. But there is something to be said for journalists who still go out there and hunt through the back doors mm-hmm. for their leads, for their mm-hmm. information, and do expository investigative stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know,
yeah,
social media, it can only do so much, you mm-hmm. know. It can do a lot, but it can't, like, mm-hmm. take it on itself and investigate and everything. So
yeah, incredible journalists, like they're trained in how to, you know, do their source their information and how to do all that really important stuff. So mm-hmm. there's something that journalists do that will never be achieved by social media. And
exactly.
Stuff. And that's important to remember.
Yeah. And draw like a thread through. And it can be a potentially very risky job.
Yeah.
So yeah, I thank you for doing that one. That was a good one.
Yeah. And while you start recommendations, I'm gonna take Mouse's squeaker toys away because oh my gosh.
Oh man, recommendations. You know, I know that we've done this every week for quite some time now, and still every week I'm like, what am I gonna recommend today? Let's see. Oh, my story is in part inspired by the fact that yesterday I started, much to my brother's excitement, playing Red Dead Redemption.
Ooh.
So I was like, you know what I should do? I feel like I should do something like the Old West. And I was like, I bet there's like a cool train robbery story.
Oh, heck yeah.
And then there kind of wasn't, but there was this. I mean, there are some, but they're just short, you know? And I was like... just not enough for like a full episode. So I was like, okay, right. What can I do? And then I found this story and I was like, oh yeah, okay, we're in business. So that's what I'm going to recommend. Red Dead Redemption, some of the most, like everyone loves, like it's Red Dead Redemption. You know how famous they are.
I
so
feel like everyone knows the name and not has played it.
Yeah.
Even I know the name.
Yeah.
It's pretty popular.
Some of the most like universally respected and,
it's almost up there with like Mario.
Yes, yeah. Red Dead is very, very, very famous. So if you have the chance to play it, I would highly recommend. And oh my god, I've been playing, because I only have a PlayStation 4 that was a hand-me-down for my brother. I never got to play the first one,
mm-hmm.
but the second one is actually a prequel. So yeah, it's like story-wise, I'm in the right order, but it's like, it's been so fun. So... And it's so fun. You know, you're just a cowboy out in the West. And I don't know if you know anything about, like, because it's completely, it's an open world game.
Oh.
And that means you could do literally whatever they want. And, like, the amount and level of detail they have put into this world is just, like, absolutely insane. To the point where, like, you have to eat food to, like, and you have to sleep. You have to,
You said food and my stomach growled. Okay, yeah.
you have to take care of yourself. You got to take care of your horse. There's all of these like little, like the animators have just put, you can tell like the level of care and detail that has been mm-hmm. put in this game. And it's just, you can really tell that it's a very well appreciated game. So that's my recommendation.
I always appreciate that too, because you can tell the creators not only had to be incredibly skilled, but have to take great pride in it to work that long.
Like that was their baby. Yeah. Yeah.
Because that kind of stuff doesn't just happen.
Yeah.
You have to like spend like years of your life on mm-hmm. that.
So that is Red Dead Redemption. I'm excited to be finally playing it. It took forever to download. Oh my god. But
oh, I'm sure
it's a big old game.
Like open world games must be a lot more like
yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's just a lot of, because they're open world, so there's just a lot of stuff that needs to be happening all at once.
Gotcha.
And my hand-me-down PlayStation 4 sounds like a jet engine taking off whenever it's like loading all that stuff, and I'm like, oh man,
like, oh boy,
explode, please.
It's like, I need you to hang in there for like a week or two more while I play this game.
I know.
And then you can die.
I know.
Not really.
So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
I have seen some stuff from Red Dead before mm-hmm. that makes me really wish video games didn't make me so.
I know.
Sick.
There's so many. We've talked about this.
I know.
Before.
I would be
there's
such a
so
gamer
many.
If I didn't get so much sick so easy.
You would really love video games. I'm so sorry for you.
I've seen some stuff lately about Last of Us that I've had to skip past, not just because it makes me motion sick, but because I don't want spoilers.
Yeah.
And it's just been making me so sad.
Yeah. Oh man. I know. That is a great tragedy. I'm sorry.
Yeah. But so. Well, very nice.
Yeah.
My recommendation, I watched two really good shows while we had our little snow days.
Nice.
One of them was absolutely phenomenal. Okay, you know what? I wasn't going to recommend it. I am, with the disclaimer that it has a lot of very adult content. It's an animated adult series.
Mm-hmm.
It is on Netflix, and I've seen a lot of people talking about it on social media, so I am just going to say it. It's Blue Eye Samurai. It is beautiful. The use of color, the style of animation, the story, the focus, the historic context, and most of all, to me, the way they focus on women's relationships with themselves and with their femininity, and the way they treat the... like prostitution and sex work in Edo, Japan is so fascinating and so well written. And it's got a stellar cast. Everyone from like Brenda Song to Kenneth Branagh. Like,
wow.
It's really good. And it's beautiful, but it does have some very adult content. So if you're, I'm pretty sure that if it was like a non-animated thing, it would probably be R, maybe even NC-17 because of some of the gore. But there is just some really graphic, like, sexual content as well. So I just want to make that disclaimer that if you are above a certain age, I highly recommend it. but if you're under a certain age, don't. Please, give it a couple years. But it is one of the rare W's that Netflix has made recently. And
nice.
It's really beautiful. And I am definitely going to make Cal watch it. We're going to have to watch it together over the next few weeks because you would love it. I believe it is the best animation I have seen since Arcane.
Okay. Yeah, I'm down. I have been caught by the Amazon household sharing stuff that's been going around.
How they
turn your account off if you're not on the home Wi-Fi.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
On Amazon or Netflix?
Yeah, sorry, Netflix.
Okay. Yeah, sorry.
No, said the wrong one.
I figured after a second, but I was like, wait, I gotta double check.
Yeah, yeah. So I haven't been able to watch a lot on Netflix, but I hate to say it, but they might wear me down where I get my own subscription. And I really hate to fold, but because that's the whole point. They want you to pay more money.
I know.
And they want to make more money, and I don't want to give them that.
I know, but dang, Blue Eye Samurai, even if it's just for like a month,
yeah.
You watch it like whole. It's gorgeous. It's beautiful.
Yeah, I know. And there's been like a few things where people like, of course, right after it happened, people were like, oh, it's actually really good. It's on Netflix. And I'm like, y'all couldn't have told me that like 2 months ago.
Right.
Ugh.
I think this one's a new drop.
Honestly. Yeah, I think it is new. Yeah.
But it's, if you've got Netflix and you are above a mature age and you judge this to be something you are interested in, viable to watch, I highly recommend it. It is beautiful. And I just really like the way that it talks about women and the diversity of their experiences, and also how some of them don't have a chance for diversity in their experience, that women suffer a lot of expectations and restrictions.
For sure.
So
awesome, cool, sounds good. We got some good stuff going today.
Yeah, we do.
Are we ready for some more?
Yeah, I am. Go for it.
Okay, so start off a little dramatic storytelling wise.
I'm ready. Do we need more sound effects? I can give Mouse her phone back. I took
the
away
train
her
noises.
Squeaky, I took away her squeaky toys.
So it's 3 a.m. on the morning of Thursday, August 8th in 1963. There is a British mail train heading from Glasgow to London. And it's about 36 miles outside of its destination. It's been going since the previous afternoon. It's a mail train, so it kind of picks up mail at every stop. It has postal employees in the train actively sorting mail, because apparently what they used to do would be like just throw mail out and then throw it back in as the train passes by.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's made this journey a million times. It's a mail train, so it goes, it's delivering mail.
It's normal routine.
Normal routine. However, something was out of the ordinary this night. As a train approaches a passing that is usually, they had a light system, so green meant you're good to go, red meant you needed to stop. As they're passing a crossing that had never been green or red before, it's red that night. And they're like, that's weird. Co-engineer of the train, David Whitby, goes to investigate. And at the light box, he is able to make out that there is a faint green glow, even though the red light is clearly activated. As he gets closer, he realizes that someone had placed a leather glove over the green light to cover it, to muffle the light. Muffle. That's not the right word, but...
To dampen.
Dampen, there we go. Yeah. Dampen the light.
Muffle isn't bad, though. I knew what you meant.
Yeah, it's just mostly a sound word, you know?
Yeah, I know what you mean, yeah.
And when he went to look at it further, someone actually had wired the red light and attached it to an external battery to turn it on. So he's like, uh-oh. So he runs to the phone that is present at every crossing, and when he picks up the receiver... He realized the line had been cut, and he was like, oh, shit. So he turns to run back to the train, and someone grabs him and overpowers him quickly. And as they incapacitate him, he sees around a dozen masked men board the train. Dun, dun, dun.
That was some beautiful storytelling right there. I enjoyed that greatly.
So, why? Why did they target the seemingly inconspicuous mail train?
Was it carrying letters from the president?
Let's let the story unfold.
Oh, okay.
So, months before August 8th, a man known only to this point, we still do not have his identity, known only as the Ulsterman, approaches known criminals in London, Gordon Goody and Buster Edwards. Gordon Goody, Bruston Edwards, and a solicitor's clerk in London named Brian Field. And he brings to them this information. He says, so, the British mail cars, all, and the train directly behind the conductor's cabin, or the conductor's car, all of the post trains have what is known as the high-value car. Oh. And this is where mail that is deemed high value is all held.
Like physically, like it's they're shipping like jewels or something? Or
yeah, so any sort of like any sort of
sorry,
the mic just made contact with
fell on my chest.
any sort of valuable mail item
okay
is in this car.
Okay.
Including all of the notes that it's collected along the way. This is just kind of like any money that would go regularly through the mail service. So
okay.
Kind of like if you're mailing money to someone, I don't know, any money. I think specifically what was being collected on this go-around was banknotes that were out of circulation or that were headed to be out of circulation. So smaller notes like $1 and $5 bills. And this was a pretty regular thing. On any given train ride, there would be about, I think I saw like in the couple hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of money on a postage train. And this is not really information that is available to the public. Or else, unless you worked for the mail services.
It's like an inside secret.
Yes. So this Ulsterman, the man who was known only as the Ulsterman, is an unnamed senior security officer within the Royal Mail. And as I said, to this day, we do not know who this man was. No idea. But he approaches these three men, Gordon Goody, Buster Edwards, and Brian Field, and says, look, you guys can make a lot of money if you stop these trains because... there is no safeguards on these high value cars at all. They don't even have bars on the windows.
Oh, jeez. I feel like this is an oversight on their own part.
It's kind of like you're asking for it.
I don't feel bad or guilty. Apparently, at all, like, at this point.
They had just like within the last like 10 years been like, maybe we should get some safety precautions on our high value train cars.
Yeah.
And they had begun the process of switching out some of the cars. But lucky for the eventual crew, this car was not one of the updated ones. So the grand plan from this Ulsterman figure was you need to go after a bank holiday and after when there's a bank holiday in Scotland, because all that money that's usually collected over the weekend with these routine trains coming along is actually tripled or even quadrupled in the train. Ooh. So if you hit this train, you have the possibility of making over $1 million in 1963's money.
Oh,
yes.
I keep reminding myself this is the 60s, not like
the 1890s. I know. I know. It's weird to have like a train robbery that early because I first saw it. I was like, 1963? But nah, that's going to be boring. But no, it's good. Mm. It's good.
Okay.
So obviously they were like, hell yeah, we're on board. So Goody and Edwards recruit their friend Bruce Reynolds, who becomes the eventual mastermind of the operation. He actually wasn't even present on the night, but he was well known in criminal circles for being a very meticulous planner. Mm. And that's what they needed to successfully pull off a train robbery like this one.
Every heist does need the brain.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they had their crew, and Reynolds had his own collections, and they, like, had a wealth of experience in the underworld, but they had no experience in robbing trains. So they have to enlist the help of another London gang called the South Coast Raiders, who were well-versed in robbing trains.
Okay.
So eventually, this group would end up being a... I think it was 16 is the final number of men involved in this heist.
Wow.
Including an old train conductor himself so that they could drive the train, getaway drivers, two solicitors to help organize the buying of a safe house location near where they were going to stop the train. Mm.
Oh, dang.
Yeah, like
this is a very involved process.
Uh-huh.
They were like, they weren't even like, hey, let's rent a house. Let's get a hotel room. They're like, let's buy a house.
We're going to buy this. There was also, they recruited one man who had done the whole light switch thing before, and he knew how to rig the light switches at train crossings to get them done. So it was very much like a heist, like they were bringing in their specialists, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Reynolds, to his credit, puts together a perfectly, like, a flawless plan. There was only one thing that ended up getting them caught.
An unexpected father-son relationship with one of the crooks who he then compromised the mission for to save his life.
Not quite.
I was just going off the movies.
I know, yeah. Yeah, so, and at the end, we have a total of 16 men and 17 if you count the Ulstermen. And while this might seem like a big crew, the payout they were hoping for would more than satisfy everyone's trouble.
Like it.
Yes. So flash forward to the night of the raid. The co-engineer has just been incapacitated. One of Bruce Reynolds, his big things was he did not want this to have any sort of violence if it can be avoided. So they did not bring guns. They brought like leather covered, bludger sticks essentially,
like batons almost.
So that they didn't want to kill anyone, they just wanted to get in, get the money, and get out as quickly and effectively as possible. And this was because it was the added charge to have armed robbery, right? And so they were not wanting to get caught with that charge.
For a second I was like, wow, they're very ethical robbers, and then I was like, oh, there's probably another reason.
Yeah, well, I think it was mostly the hey, if there's murder, then that's a whole other
capital punishment.
That's a whole other kind of crime
versus misdemeanor.
Exactly. Well,
although at that amount of money, it's probably grand theft anyway.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Like,
oh yeah. So the men board the train and they are able to incapacitate the conductor, and they bring on the old train conductor that they had recruited, But they hit a snag. And the old Grange trajectory had been retired for so long that the newer trains were too technologically advanced for him to drive.
Oh, no.
So the plan was, where they had stopped the plan, they couldn't bring up their vehicles to load in the money because it was like pretty steep into like ditches right by the track. So they needed to move the train about 800 meters or half a mile further down the track. They were like, okay, so our the guy we brought in to drive the train can't drive the train, so they have to wake the conductor back up.
Oh, we're like, my gosh.
Hey, we need you to drive the train. So they did. So they had the train, they like kind of roused him. They had him drive the train down, and this had been very meticulously planned to be within 30 minutes. Bruce Reynolds did not want them to be more than 30 minutes, because after that amount of time, you could have people start to do things, and it could risk the people that they didn't want to kill. It could risk the cops getting alerted sooner than they needed to,
yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. But all in all, within the span of about 15 to 20 minutes after they had moved the train down to where the vehicles were located, they were able to move all but 8 of the 128 sacks from the high-value parcel car. Yes, this totaled just around $2 million in 1963, the equivalent of about $60 million in today's money.
Oh.
This was way bigger of a load than they had anticipated. They were expecting for around $1 million. So when they got around $2 million, they were happy. You know, they were like, we're at our time. We can leave those 8 bags. Sure, it's around $100,000, but you know what? I'll keep it. As a tip, the mail workers, they should have been like, if you don't tell the cops, we won't say where that money went. You can just say when it took it. Yeah. So they had pre-planned.
I can't imagine how physically strenuous it would have to be to move that much money that fast, but also the adrenaline rush you have doing that, knowing how much money is in every bag. You're just like, I don't care.
Insane.
My body's falling apart.
Yeah.
I don't care. I keep
and
going.
Since there was... like 12 men involved in this operation, thankfully they were able to like get it out as fast as they could, because they formed kind of a human train, like a conveyor belt, and they just kind of passed the bags as quickly as they could into their vehicles. They had purchased 2 Land Rover vehicles identical and fixed them both with 2 identical registration plates in order to, that were fake, of course, to throw off any sort of pursuit. And then they had, as I mentioned earlier, had already located a safe house location and went to the length of purchasing that. It was a farm close enough to the tracks that they could get there on minor roads, but far enough away that they were hopeful that the police wouldn't find them. Mm-hmm. Another advantage of this farm, it was known as Leatherslade Farm, was that it was so just kind of unremarkable that it wasn't even on maps. So they were hoping that when police were planning like a search route to go find them, that they would just not see the farm
and look over,
and it would be a total overlook. So they get to the farm, they have their money, they get to the farm, they let the train go. The train does what it does, continues down the line eventually. The farm was located 27 miles or 43 kilometers from the crime scene. They get there around 4:30, and this is when they discover, oh my God, we got double of what we were anticipating. And they are full celebrating mode. So much so that they start, and they had stocked this farm to last as their hideout for weeks. They were planning to stay here for 2 to 3 weeks, long enough to kind of let the initial search fade away, and then eventually return to their lives or go flee the country, whatever they're going to do with their new found cut of the money. And it was anticipated that each of the people would receive around $150,000, which I didn't do the conversion for that, but £150,000 out of $2 million is at least a couple million in today's money. So they were all going to be sitting real pretty after this was all said and done. So they were in good spirits. And since they had planned to be there for a couple weeks, not only did they bring food and drink enough to last that amount of time, they also brought some things to entertain them. One of which was a Monopoly game, which as they were counting the money, a few members of the gang were sitting down to play Monopoly with real money.
Oh my.
And celebrate the successful heist that they had just pulled off. But they had a snag. And the cops...
Did someone not let them play the thimble on the board? Someone insisted on that.
Who was the train is what I want to know.
Oh my gosh, you're right.
They, of course, had police scanner radio so they could pay attention to when the crime was discovered, because they knew it would be eventually, and just...
Again, I keep thinking this is like the
1850s. I know, right? Isn't it crazy?
Scanner radio.
It doesn't help that it's like they're on a farm now.
Like, I'm trying to think of people in like beehive hair now.
Yeah, like, I know, like in like suits and stuff, like,
right? Pre-disco, 60s. Not like Annie Oakley.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, so they hear on the police radio. Oh my god, the police found out way sooner. They knew the police were going to find out. Eventually, obviously, but the police ended up finding out way sooner than they anticipated, because something like a train that had passed by them, they like were able to pass word to that train. That train went to one of its crossings with the phone not cut and were able to alert the police from there. So they were like, oh crap, like the police found out way sooner. And the police were actually smarter than they anticipated in their approach to the search, because they were like, okay, it's been about 30 minutes since this robbery had happened.
They can't have gone that far.
So they start literally like door to door in a 45 to 50 kilometer radius, which was about how far a car could travel in that time, going door to door and finding and looking for them. So they were like, crap, this hideout that we were going to spend weeks in, we now have to leave by like tomorrow. And so they do, but worry not, they had a fail safe. Bruce Reynolds had already hired an arsonist to completely destroy any evidence that they had been there, because obviously even if they found the farm, there was stuff that they had touched in the building, and it would be really easy to lift fingerprints.
Police investigation exists at this point.
Yep, exactly. They have the technology. So, and because a lot of these men were criminals in the criminal underworld, they had been arrested and booked before, and their fingerprints were in the system, so it was really like they needed that arsonist to get rid of everything.
Yeah.
So Friday, I believe it was Friday night, they vacated the premises and they had alerted the arsonist, hey, we need you to go burn this bar down. But unbeknownst to them, the arsonist did not show. He had taken the money they had given him and ran.
Wow, it's almost like you can't trust a criminal
to right?
do criminal things and to pay them up front.
Yeah, maybe don't do that. This is kind of like criminal 101, and you guys should know that as criminals.
Until you see the quality of the work.
Yep. So, around this time, too, a nearby resident had become suspicious of all of a sudden this farm that had been abandoned for decades. There's all these men there, and they're all, you know, they've got these really nice cars and brand new Land Rovers. Mm-hmm. And they're like, what's going on over there? And he hears about the theft, and he's like, oh, you know what? So he's calling the police. He's calling them over and over again. The police are not listening to him at first, and then finally a little too late to catch them red-handed at the farm, but soon enough to find many things with fingerprints all over it, because the arsonist did not come, including the Monopoly board that had fingerprints
that's hilarious all
over it. So one by one, and you can literally, like, on the Wikipedia page, they break it down by every member of this gang and how they were apprehended. So you can go and read that.
Oh, did they split? They split up?
Well, they all, like, ran, you know? Oh, okay. Yeah. They had all gotten their money and they ran to try to, like, go avoid being arrested. But... So a couple things happened. One, most of the men, while some of them did like leave the country, which
that's the first reaction.
Yeah. A lot of the men hoped that with how large London was, they would just be able to kind of return to London and blend in with the crowd. However, this plan would have worked, but there was an informant that came forward, and it's not known who this informant was either. Most likely what the thought is, it was like someone in prison looking to shorten their time, who was maybe friends with one of these, or maybe even approached to be in the gang, but had gotten arrested before and imprisoned before he was able to. So he knew the details of the plan, and he was able to supply, I think, 10 to 12 names of the men involved. So he had very deep knowledge. And so
they're selling out your friends, and then they're selling out your rich friends.
Exactly. And they're criminal rich friends. Not usually a good thing. So the police, with this list of men and with their fingerprints, which the fingerprints, they were able to match it up to the names that the informant had provided. They went to the press, and the press posts the names of the men and their pictures, all of them, all over the place, everywhere. So much so that one of the men, who actually was trying to stay undercover at a friend's house, just, like, lay low at a friend's house until he could find a way out of the country, like, one of the first nights he was staying there, one of the neighbors recognized him from the press, got him and the friend arrested as, and the friend arrested as an accessory after the fact. So he was one of the people charged in this, in this, whole operation. So, several of them were arrested throughout London as they tracked them down. They were also able to track kind of spending habits of the list of names that they had. And if all of a sudden someone starts spending something a lot, mm-hmm. that's pretty suspicious. There was one man named Ronnie Biggs who received a 30-year sentence, but he was actually able to escape from the Wandsworth prison only 15 months after his sentencing. He eventually fled to Australia, and then from Australia he flew to Brazil, and this took most of the money that he had left. Yeah. However, Brazil had no extradition treaty with the UK, and so he was able to live his life fully as himself in Brazil until he was 71, and he decided to return to the UK in May of 2001, stating that he wanted to drink, it was like a pint in some pub, as a proper Englishman, which, like, dude, okay. He was old at that point. I think he had suffered 3 heart attacks. So I think he knew what was going to happen when he returned to the UK, because of course he was arrested as soon as he stepped off the plane.
Yeah.
Bruce Reynolds himself actually flees to Mexico with his wife and his son, Nick. However, was spending well above his means and ran through his money pretty quickly. And then for what it's worth, though, he did take quite some time for the investigators in England to track him down. 5 years, and he received 10 years of a sentence. As the mastermind, he wasn't quite there. And I think that was he was able to get his sentence down to 10. That was kind of like what's the word? He fought it. He
appealed it?
Appealed. Yes, he appealed the sentencing. Because what the courts had done is they wanted to make an example of these men.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And in total, they received a total prison sentence of 307 years. Now, this was not a great move for the court to do, because while they thought they were making an example of these, what a lot of other criminals saw was, wow, those people who robbed that train and didn't kill anyone and didn't have any guns received max sentences for robbing someone. So if they're going to get that, then I'm going to might as well have my gun.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it kind of backfired on them, literally.
Literally.
So, all in all, there was only one of the men who were taken to court that did not get sentenced. And this was actually the brother-in-law of one of the original, the original men who put the plan together. I forget which one now, but he was able to argue that, you don't have my name on any sort of the information that was given to you by any of these sources. And also, like, I hung out with my brother-in-law all the time. We played Monopoly all the time. Sure, my fingerprints were on that board, but I was over at his house a couple weeks ago, so you can't place me in that barn. And it worked. He was the only one that was acquitted of charges and was able to get off scot-free.
Do we know if he was actually guilty? Like,
oh, yeah. Okay. He was for sure involved. Yes. Yeah, yeah. I think he was, like, the getaway driver or something. Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yep, mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, that is kind of the end of things. The legacy is, this is one of the largest cash robberies in UK history. Definitely the largest train heist amount lifted at one time. However, despite the fact that they were able to apprehend most of the men involved, they were only ever able to recover around £400,000 out of the original £2 million loot. So not even 25% of the money was recovered. And it's thought that just through, like, hiding places and families and everything. And these are, like, small bills, right? Because they were taking out of circulation. Yeah. So they're not traceable. Wow. It's not like 20 is where they have, like, you know, codes or the pin,
the serials.
Serial numbers. Yes. On them or anything.
Wow.
So yeah, of course there have been many, many book, TV show, and even play adaptations. This also was the first time I had seen on a in popular culture section of a Wikipedia page that they have a model train section of that.
Really?
Yes. There was two model train ones, but the one that was most recent was the Luton Model Railway Club has a diorama that portrays the scene of the robbery. And apparently in the first Red Dead Redemption game, there is a mission you have to play that follows this, that seems to follow the same kind of setup as this train robbery.
Interesting.
And probably one of the most interesting and, oh my God, no way parts of this was that Nick Reynolds' son, or the son of Bruce Reynolds, while he was in Mexico City, kind of took up some music. And eventually he would join a band called the Alabama Three. And they would eventually record a track in which he plays the harmonica in 2005 that the next year would be used as the theme song for the 2006 hit television show The Sopranos. So the son of one of London's criminal world's most famous men, the mastermind of the great train robbery, is on the theme song for The Sopranos. And that is just such a...
And then we call that full circle.
Mm-hmm. Perfect, perfect moment there. And wow. Yeah, that is the great train robbery of London in 1963.
I'm having such a... Like, it's so cool. You did such a good job. I'm having such a hard time, like, visually imagining a 1960s.
It's such a jarring thing because when you think of train robberies, you're like... That's why I blew past this one first because I was like, what is that? I'm not... No, I'm going Old West, you know?
Oh my gosh.
But no,
I'm like imagining, like I can even, my brain even lets me do 1940s, like clothing wise. Right, and
yeah.
Like structure because
it's
trains.
Like trains. Yeah, 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 makes
but
sense.
But like 1960, that's going to take a bit for me to adjust to.
And there's actually, there's pictures online that you can find of the train itself, of the glove over the light in the box. There's there's pictures of like, as much as they could take pictures of, they did because it's the 60s and they can take pictures. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really cool. I'm so glad you did that.
Wasn't it fun? I was like, I'm in a mood to do kind of something a little heisty, a little fun.
Well, the Old West never truly dies. We know that.
That's true.
Wow.
Yep. So, yeah.
That made me wish that I had instead recommended the other TV show I watched. But I'll leave that for next week.
Next week. Next week. Yep.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, now that I get to have an existential crisis about the decades I can imagine trains in.
Yep.
Wow. That's cool.
It was fun, right?
Yeah.
That was a fun little story. I was listening to some podcasts on it and I was like, oh my God. Wow. And like I said, you can get way, way detailed on the whole like court proceeding and everything. As with any sort of like big police investigation and then court that's like pretty public, they have very meticulous, like step by step, day by day, hour by hour accounts of it that you can find. So if you want to look more closely into it. Also, one thing I will note, I think this is one of those things that got really caught up in popular culture and kind of like became mythologized pretty quickly.
Oh, mm-hmm.
So a lot of the details, like you'll see like kind of small details vary from place to place. So I try to take like the most kind of consistent account of things that I heard and do my best with that. But if you're reading like one article versus another, they might like tell the story about how the co-engineer got passed out or incapacitated a little differently. So just a heads up. But
wow. Well, fantastic job.
Thank you.
If anyone has any more like fun this happened in what decade stories, we would love to cover them.
Yeah.
If there's one you want to learn about, let us know by tweeting at us at TINAHL podcast.
Or you can email us at thisisnotahistorylecture@gmail.com.
And we love a good review if you're willing to, you know, leave one for us on any of the platforms.
We very much appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Every review you leave is one more time that Mouse actually decides to be quiet while we're recording.
she had to get out her wiggles.
Her wiggles, yeah.
Yes.
And I guess in the meantime, thank you for everyone who was listening. Stay safe and healthy. But as always, just remember that this has not been
a history
lecture.
Bye. Bye.